Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrar's Food Safety Inc. podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions relevant to both the food safety industry as well as cannabis and hemp. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjrfsi.com/webinars or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Or good morning, you know, depending on where you're joining us from. Welcome to today's webinar, Allergen Management in 2021, Rules and Tools for Safe Foods. My name's Amy. I'm a member of the marketing team here at Perry Johnson Registrar's Food Safety, Inc. I'll be facilitating today's webinar and offering technical support to our speakers. Just to start us off, I do want to apologize for a little late start. Some of those aforementioned technical support issues did pop up, but thank you for your patience. Today, we're very excited to be welcoming Emily Kaufman, the president of Emport LLC, for the presentation, and we'll be introducing her to you a little bit later on in the presentation. But just before we get started, I want to go over some housekeeping notes. To ensure audio quality, all of the attendees on the call today are on mute. However, we do absolutely want to take any questions you might have. So to ask a question, you can go ahead and type it into the questions tab of the GoToWebinar control panel on your screen and just click send. They'll pop up on our end and we'll answer as many of them as we have time for at the end of the prepared slides. But now I'm going to go ahead and introduce our first speaker today. That is Paul DeMarin. He is the Senior Vice President of Food Safety and Supply Chain here at PJRFSI. Paul joined the company in January of 2020 and has over 35 years of experience in the hospitality, service, and retail agri-food sectors. Paul's a board member of the OFPA, that's the Ontario Food Protection Association, and he's also an advisory council member with the George Washington University School of Business for their digital marketing certificate program. Before he came to PJRFSI, Paul worked for 17 years in the certification industry with clients in every sector from food safety and supply chain to brand protection and quality. Paul's also worked for many years in management system certification. And prior to that, he was a professional chef and a consultant for over 20 years. So Paul, I will hand things over to you and we can take it away.
Great. Thank you very much, Amy. Thank you, everyone. I do, again, apologize for the delay. That was completely on me. I was having computer issues. So thank you for your patience. At this time, it's my pleasure to welcome you all here and introduce you to our first speaker, Emily Kaufman. Emily is the president for Emport LLC, and she founded the company back in 2011 with the motto of more safe food, more happy people. Although it was originally focused on developing the Glutox line of rapid tests, she since expanded their catalog to include rapid tests for additional allergens and other food safety concerns. And Emily is someone with a restricted diet herself. I know she takes great pride in helping to ensure consumer safety. So just before we pass it off, some of Emily's highlights include the US launch of both the Glutox Pro and the Allertox Sticks. She had 10 years of working with gluten-free and allergen-free food manufacturers, as well as 20 years of eating gluten-free herself. As always, I'm going to interact with Emily throughout the webinar and ask a few questions. So please do remember, as Amy mentioned, to get your questions in, and we're going to address those towards the end. So with that, Emily, I think you're going to come on screen here. We look forward to your presentation, and thank you so much for joining us.
All right, and thank you, Paul, for the introduction. Hi, everybody. I hope you can see me and hear me. If not, I'm sure someone will send me a little chat and we will adjust. I'm gonna stay on the screen at least for this first slide, and then I may just go ahead and take myself off so that we can focus on the text. So today, what we are going to talk about quickly, we'll talk about the legal landscape for allergens and for gluten, how they're different and how they're the same, how they're different and how they're the same between Canada and the United States. From there, we'll talk a little bit about the all of the acronyms that you'll be exposed to when you start thinking about how you're going to be testing for allergens, what are the tools that are available to you, and what are their strengths and weaknesses. We'll talk about the types of questions that you're going to need to be thinking about when you're deciding what you want to be testing and when and how. And then we'll have a little bit of time to talk about two related areas of food safety that I'm seeing our customers and clients think about more and more. And those are, what are we talking about when we're talking about validation and verification? specifically as it pertains to gluten and allergens, and then also proficiency testing. What is it? Why is it? Do I need to? If I want to, how would I go about doing that? And then we should have some time for questions. So to jump, let's see, and why did, there we go. Okay. So I'm gonna go ahead and take myself off of the camera now. I'll come back on at the end for the Q&A. There we go. So when we're talking about allergen labeling laws, we're talking about laws that are required, that are non-optional for packaged foods. And we are talking about laws that are designed to help the food allergic consumer figure out at a glance if there's a problem waiting for them in a given food that they might want to be buying. So they were originally written with an eye towards intentional known ingredients in a product. Some things that the laws have in common on either side of the border, there's not an acceptable part per million or part per billion threshold for allergens. And both sides of the border, you need to be a little bit careful with the way that you're thinking about may contain statements, precautionary statements. They have a real purpose, they're important. They're not there for you to use as CYA statements, for lack of a better term. If you need them, you need them, but they don't necessarily absolve you from taking responsibility for careful day-to-day procedures. You also want to be careful with your free from peanut, free from milk, free from gluten statements. Those are equally, they're not regulated. You can use them if you want, but you don't have to. If you're going to make a claim like that, you need to be quite confident that your claim is accurate. When we think about allergen as a term, it means different things to different people. And so that's one space where you do want to be a little bit careful. You'll see a lot of reference to things that are allergen-free. And there are actually about 200 food proteins that can cause an allergic reaction in someone. And there are not 200 foods that are covered under these laws. So for example, in Canada, you wouldn't want to use the phrase allergen-free on a food because there's a good chance that somewhere someone is allergic to one of the ingredients. You can certainly say that something is free from allergens A, B, and C, or free from the top X allergens, but allergen-free as a term requires a little bit of care. And when we're talking about the original laws that came out, the general expectation was that you would have GMPs in place to control accidental allergen cross-contact, but that was not the original intention behind those laws. And to dig into them a little bit deeper, in Canada and in the United States, a number of those top allergens are shared. Wheat, soy, shellfish, specifically crustacean, so that's your shrimp, your lobster, etc. Peanut, milk, fish, egg, and sesame will be joining the list of shared allergens shortly. It's been in Canada for quite some time now. In the United States, it's coming through in just a little while. And then if you're in Canada, you also need to be mindful of mustard and mollusk shellfish. So that's your clams, your mussels, your scallops, etc. In both countries, you need to care about tree nuts, but what tree nuts means is a little bit different. So in Canada, we're talking about 9 specific nuts. You can see them listed there. I won't bore you with listening to me list them out. Stateside, there are more nuts covered. You can find a list on the FDA's website. The two that I'd like to call out today as being different are chestnut and coconut, because I think that, to my mind at least, those are the ones that you're most likely to see used on a regular basis. And then gluten and sulfites are complicated enough that they get a slide of their own. Sulfites, all I really have to say about them in the context of this webinar is that in both countries, you need to be labeling them if they're above 10 parts per million, but they are included as a priority allergen in Canada. And the labeling requirements in the States are separate from VLCPA, the allergen labeling stateside. So if you don't have your ducks in a row with sulfites, you can absolutely have a recall triggered on both sides of the border, but the mechanism for it is a little bit different. And then with gluten, we have even more differences, and we'll spend a lot of time talking about gluten today. In Canada, it is, like everything else we've been talking about so far, it is considered a priority allergen, whereas in the United States, it is not. So there are gluten labeling laws that we'll get to on the next slide in the United States. But if you don't want to care about gluten stateside, you don't have to. Oats are also treated differently, and we can talk about that more at the end if people have questions. You can use oats in gluten-free foods in Canada and the United States. However, the expectation within Canada is that the oats will be labeled very specifically as gluten-free oats because they are in some ways uniquely amongst food items, almost certain to be contaminated with gluten in the production process if they haven't been produced very carefully with the explicit aim of being gluten-free. And another thing that I just like to mention when we talk about gluten, gluten isn't always the same thing as wheat. Wheat is not always the same thing as gluten.
Emily, if you can just confirm for us a little bit more here what you are referring to with respect to wheat and gluten.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's kind of like a rectangle. A square is a rectangle, but a rectangle isn't always a square, right? So when we're talking about gluten, we're talking about the protein found in wheat, barley, rye, and related grains. When we're talking about wheat, of course, we're just talking about wheat. And so there are items that you can find on the stores that are wheat-free, but that still contain a bunch of gluten. There are, for example, a lot of those breads that have a lot of barley or rye in them, but no wheat. And those can be produced and they don't need to be labeled as containing wheat. So you wouldn't need that kind of a statement for an allergen call out in the United States, but they do still very much have gluten in them. So you would not be able to call them gluten-free. And in Canada, you would still need to be calling out that statement at the bottom. And on the flip side, you can find that there are particular ways that wheat can be processed to physically remove the gluten, physically remove the protein. Most commonly, you'll find wheat starches and occasionally glucose syrups. You'll find them more in Europe than you will in North America, but they can be used as part of gluten-free foods. They do still require a wheat label on them. Yeah. So moving right along.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about taking a little bit of a step side to side. And I should explain my pictures here. I tried to draw everybody a flow chart to explain all this and it didn't come out great. So that's why we just got a lot of text and a little bit of jumping around to get through. But if you fast forward a little bit from the allergen laws that we were talking about, the logical evolution, the sort of logical next step in allergen management is covered under FSMA as well as the Safe Food for Canadians regulations, which are more recent. And they are addressing many, many, many things, as everyone on this webinar knows. But for what we're talking about today, whereas the original laws covered ingredients that everyone would expect to have in the food that are allergens and that might catch consumers by surprise, well, now we also have to think about unintentional allergen cross-contact. And the reason for that is that in Canada and in the United States, allergens are now considered a hazard. And because they are a hazard under these regulations, they require preventative controls. So as you're thinking about your general food safety plan and you're looking at things that could go wrong, you have to think about, well, an allergen in a place that I didn't expect it to be is something that could go wrong. Well, now that you've thought about that, you've got to figure out how to fix it. And two things to sort of keep in mind. Part of these rules is the need for documentation. If you haven't documented it functionally, you haven't done it. So write it all down and put it somewhere that you can find it if you need it. And you also need to consider your supplier's plans, because if you get sent something that's problematic and you don't catch the problem and you make someone sick, that's your problem too, for lack of a nicer way to put that. So that's what we're thinking about when we're thinking about allergens now, both things we know about and things that we might not expect to have in our food. When we're talking about gluten, and specifically only in the United States gluten, as I mentioned, it's voluntary. If you don't want to label a food as gluten-free, that's totally fine. If you are going to label a food as gluten-free, you need to be very confident that if it gets tested, it's going to have less than 20 parts per million of gluten in it. And if there is that little bit of gluten, it needs to be there from, again, unavoidable cross-contact, despite you having a good plan in place. And I'm sorry, I'm taking a sip of tea here. The opposite would be, you know, can I use I have a spice blend or a minor ingredient. I know it has a small amount of gluten, but I've done the math, and with my formula, the amount of gluten would be under 20 parts per million, and that's not okay. That's you can't use math to knowingly include any amount of gluten in your product. There are some additional pieces of guidance that came out last year around ways that gluten can be modified or removed. And to touch on them very quickly, if you are working with gluten that has been fermented or hydrolyzed, which are processes that physically change the shape of the gluten, unfortunately, there's no great way to test to determine whether fermented or hydrolyzed gluten is still present in any particular food. So if that's something that you're working with, you need to be very sure that you can demonstrate that before the food underwent, or liquid or supplement underwent that procedure, that it was gluten-free. And that covers, and explicitly no exemptions were made if you have a product or an enzyme that was grown on a gluten-containing media. That's a real challenge when it comes to gluten-free. If you cannot prove that it was gluten-free before it underwent hydrolyzation fermentation, you cannot use it in a gluten-free item. On a happier note, distillation is considered a process that physically removes the gluten. And so as long as your facility is set up with good GMPs so that you can be quite confident that the item, once it's been distilled, is staying separate from the ingredients that that went into the still, then you can make a gluten-free claim. Distillation removes protein, so a protein test can be used to determine that if there's no protein in the finished product, it can be safely considered gluten-free. And with all of these, just as with everything else, I'm gonna say it a whole bunch of times, records, records, records. You're gonna wanna keep records. So one thing you'll notice, lots of rules, many slides worth of rules, no rule about testing your foods. You could, and I am sure that someone out there is, producing items that are fully compliant with gluten and allergen regulations, and for some reason doesn't need to run any sort of testing. There's always someone who doing something. I'm sure someone's out there. I have not met them. And the reason for that is that really, once you start going and looking for those hazards, you're probably going to find at least one. And even if you didn't, you may find that your customers, and that could be the grocery store that's carrying your food, it could be the manufacturer that wants to buy your ingredient. In either case, oftentimes they will want to see a certificate of analysis. They'll want to see that you did run some amount of testing so that they can go ahead and bring your product on with an additional measure of confidence. And so the long and short of it is, if you go in knowing that you'll probably need to spend a little bit of money and a little bit of time incorporating testing into your day-to-day, your week-to-week, your month-to-month, you will very likely wind up saving yourself time and money in the long run. Okay, so now we get into allergen testing and the various tools that are out there for everyone. So the first two, you'll see pictures there of our GlutenTox Pro and our GlutenTox Home, which are lateral flow kits. I'm gonna jump around on this slide a little bit here. Lateral flow kits are great for day-to-day use. And the reason for that is that they're relatively quick, cheap, and easy. Of course, not all kits are the same. Some kits require some equipment, some kits do not. But on the whole, you're going to find them to be easier than your ELISAs, which we'll talk about as well. Lateral flow devices give you a clear yes or no answer. We found it or we didn't find it. And generally speaking, you can find lateral flow kits that are able to test both foods, liquids, rinse water, surfaces. They have quite a wide number of things that they can be used to evaluate. They are the sister product of ELISA testing. Both ELISAs and lateral flow tests are using antibodies to look for specific proteins. So you would have an LFD or an ELISA for, let's say, peanut or for gluten or for milk. And both of them are kind of functionally looking for the same component of the food. ELISAs are the gold standard for a few reasons. They're quantitative. So rather than telling you, yes, I found it, or no, I didn't find it, the ELISA is telling you, I found it. And in fact, I found 17 parts per million or 32 parts per million or whatever the case may be. And there are different, again, there are different ELISAs that have different times and places to be the most useful. All of them require relatively more time, gear, and skill than your lateral flow kits. And they also only really start to become cost effective when you're testing a number of items at the same time. So while there are absolutely places where they make sense at the facility level, at the manufacturing level, by and large, we find that they are more popular at the lab level because, of course, the labs are working with more things from more people and have a whole team that'll be comfortable using the equipment. And a big thing that I need to point out, of course, I said this a little bit, not all kits are going to be a good fit for all products. It's really, really, really important that you validate the particular kit that you want to use against the particular product that you're working with. And we'll talk about validation at the end, but it bears repeating, wherever you're buying the kits from, whoever you're working with should be really happy to look at you, look at what you're doing, and help guide you towards or away from the products that they carry.
Emily, I have a question. What do you think are some of the foods that are more challenging for these kits?
Yeah, so good question, right? It's not helpful of me to just say some things are tricky without talking about which they are. And it depends a little bit on which allergen we're talking about here. So on a more general level, items that are high in fat, items that have undergone tricky processes, like we talked about fermentation, hydrolysis, malting, high heat, all of those things can change the shape of the protein, and that can make it a little bit of a challenge for these kits to identify the protein. And on a specific level, you can also see that certain allergens have their own additional peculiarities, I guess. So for example, if you were working with whey powder, you might need to do some amount of milk testing. There are kits out there that test for casein only, and that would not be the right kit for you to use. You'd want to use either a general milk test. Well, that would probably be the recommendation, something that was also looking for beta-lactoglobulin. And again, everyone's kind of got their own special set of challenges, and that's where working with a reputable vendor can be really, really helpful in saving you a whole bunch of headache.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, so we're almost done with different types of testing, but not quite. Along with the ELISAs and the lateral flows, which both again are looking for the protein, there are also general protein swabs out there. We work with the AllerSNAP, but there are a number of them, and they can be a great supplement to your more specific allergen tests. The reason that I say supplement is that they're not specific. So they're looking for protein and they don't care where the protein is from. The good news about them is that they're going to be cheaper and easier to use than your lateral flows and certainly than your ELISAs. They are also, though, less sensitive, and they can only be used for surface swabbing. So they help, but they don't they're not a one-stop shop. And another thing that, again, can help but isn't going to be a one-stop shop would be your PCR testing. Unlike the other tests that we've talked about, PCR tests are looking for DNA or RNA. They're not looking for protein. We find that they can make sense in a lab environment, but we don't see a lot of use for them within our clientele at the moment. They can be a little bit delicate to run, and certainly they're not as easy as your lateral flow tests. That being said, if a lab is suggesting that you use PCR, there's probably a really good reason for it. For example, if you're thinking about a low protein food like celery, which we don't have to monitor here, but in some countries you do, you'd want to be using PCR because it's, to my knowledge, there's not a celery protein kit on the market. And PCR would be an easier way to find it if it were present in a food. You got to be a little careful with them though, because since you're looking for DNA, milk looks like a hamburger, egg looks like a chicken. So when they're useful, they're very useful, but when they're not useful, they can cause false alarms. You need to be confident that they're looking for what you want to be looking for. And a little quick additional note there about ATP testing. It's really popular. It's great. It's a great way to measure general cleanliness, but you want to be a little bit careful if it's part of your allergen program, because not all certification bodies will accept it. So it's not something that we would point people towards, just so that they don't, develop a program and then find out that they need to actually replace it with, again, a general protein swab or a lateral swab. So breezing right along, when we think about doing our testing on site, I know I've talked about labs a lot, but primarily we're here to talk about what people need to do on the ground in the day-to-day. And what you're doing is really answering three questions for yourself. Question one, how do I confirm that my ingredients are free of whichever allergens or gluten it is that I'm thinking about? Thing two, how can I feel really confident that my environment is free of those same allergens? And of course, the reason that you care about your ingredients and your environment is to confirm that your finished products are also free of any unexpected allergens. And so when you're thinking about these three points, what you want to kind of keep in mind is what works for one facility or one recipe won't necessarily be true of another. And when we think about ingredients particularly, you'll know whether or not you need to be checking them based on what your supplier's risk level is. And I always encourage people, if someone tells you that they know the product is fine just because they know it, that's a big red flag, and that would put me on high alert. I would want to know exactly what my supplier was doing to have confidence on their end. And when we think about environmental testing, we're talking about surfaces, we're talking about rinse water, and we're talking about how if you get a positive, whether it's a protein swab or a specific allergen swab, it's telling you something has gone wrong in your cleaning. You're going to want to re-clean and maybe look at your cleaning procedures if they don't seem to be doing the job. And then finished product, of course, you may need to test it because of a third-party program. You may want to be doing it just for your own peace of mind. You may want to be doing it as an additional check on your cleaning program. The first off the line can be a nice additional data point to test.
Emily, when would you want to get a lab involved?
Well, labs are wonderful for a number of reasons. One, kind of before you get into your day-to-day, a lab can absolutely help you validate that your kit is going to be a good fit for your needs. You may find that you wanted to use a kit in-house, but you have a really challenging set of matrices and that you want to be using a lab for everything because you need to be working with ELISA testing or PCR testing. You may, on a sort of more relaxed note, you may find that when you get a positive result, part of your process is to just instantly send it off to a lab for verification and for quantification. And of course, you may also just find that your customers are demanding that third party certificate from someone who doesn't have the same stake in whether the answer is what they want or not. So when you're thinking about whether or not to test, and you're thinking about these three questions, ingredients, environment, finished product, what you're wondering is, okay, well, if I don't run a test for it, where am I getting my confidence from? And that might be, well, because the product has been tested already. If so, when was it tested? Why did it need to get tested then? And why was that, why only then, right? Another time when we can see a real danger point happening is if it's your responsibility to be moving the product from one area to another. Is there a contamination risk that comes with that transfer? And if so, how do I mitigate it? How do I confirm that things are going the way they should? If you are aware of any recalls on the product, whether they've happened and been your particular headache or just been a headache out there in the industry, I always advise people to keep their ear to the ground, because if you are seeing recalls, it can be a good sign that it's an ingredient that merits a little bit of additional attention, at least for the time being. And then, of course, the easiest question, do I have a third-party certification program that requires me to test? Of course, I say that's the easiest question, because if so, well, then there's your answer, right? They said you need to test, so you test.
And if an ingredient comes with a may contain statement, does that facility have to test it every time?
That's a great question. And if you were calling me as a customer and saying, do I need to test this? I would encourage you to do so. As we talked about a couple of slides ago, those may contain statements are really the intention and the hope with using them is that they're only there if they really need to be there. So if your supplier feels that they really do need to tell you that this risk is something that you're accepting as you accept the food, then I would say it's worth spending, the $10 or $20 to go ahead and take a moment to confirm that there hasn't been something unexpected. If they're just telling you like, well, we just put them on everything, then that's not great. That's not great for a number of reasons. And I'll also mention, if you're finding the statements to be a real challenge, you can always push back on them, see if you can get them to take on some of the testing, and that may take it off of your plate. And to sort of finish our thinking about in-house tests, the things to kind of keep in mind, you've got to know your team. Make sure you get them kits that they can use and use correctly. Otherwise, you might as well just throw the money away. And you've got to know your products. Some products are really easy to test, and you'll be able to use any kit that you like. Some products are a little bit more challenging. Know that a test kit that has, for example, like an AOAC PTM evaluation, the GlutenTox Pro does, for example, which is great because it means that it's undergone a lot of scrutiny. But it doesn't mean, just because a kit has been evaluated by the AOAC, it doesn't mean that that kit is instantly going to be good for every product out there. It doesn't take away the need to validate. And conversely, just because a kit doesn't hold a certification doesn't mean that it might not be a very good kit for your needs. So it's a nice thing to have, but it doesn't make your decision for you one way or the other. And whatever it is that you do buy, just make sure you're getting it from someone who is there to help you use them once that package arrives. And obviously, I'm a little biased. I like the GlutenTox and the AllerTox. There are other good kits out there. And so just make sure that what you're using is going to give you accurate results for the products and the situations that you'll be bringing that test kit up against. Okay, I feel like we're making good time. Thank you for bearing with me, everybody. Last handful of slides, validation and verification very quickly. We're seeing these questions come up more and more. When we talk about validation, we're talking about a number of things, but two of them are, how do I know that my cleaning plan is working and removing allergens from my environment before my allergen, whichever allergen it is, my allergen-free products? And two, how do I know that my test kits, my tools, are working to confirm that my cleaning program did what it needed to do? So what you need to do when you're going through a validation is you need to say, okay, if there were to be a problem, whether that's we did our peanut butter cookie dough and then we did a clean and our cleaning didn't work or didn't happen, will my test kit actually pick up that peanut contamination that's going to be on my surfaces? So did my tools work? And then two, if I did my, will the way that we like to clean remove the allergen in question from the surfaces? And that's something that you'll want to do on a regular basis, but not every day. You don't need to prove that your kits work every single day. What you do need to do every single day is verify, right? So you know you've done the validation. You know that if there is a problem, your tools are going to catch the problem. You know that there shouldn't be a problem because your cleaning program should be taking care of what it needs to take care of. Verification says we did the thing that we said we were going to do, and we did it thoroughly and correctly. And the key with verification, as with validation, I said it before, I'll say it again, record keeping, records, 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 keep records. Keep in mind also when you are working on your validation, it doesn't have to be expensive, but it might cost a little bit of money. Go ahead and ask your test kit suppliers for ideas. They may be able to help you think about how to validate the products. Do your documentation and know that your validation is likely going to be repeated at a minimum of yearly. But if your ingredients, your processes, or your personnel change, you may need to redo a validation more frequently. And when I say ingredients, I don't just mean the ingredients in your foods. It could be processing aids. It could be a change in your cleaning materials. Anything in that facility that's changing might merit a new validation.
Emily, I was going to ask a question on your verification slide, but in your opinion, is there a set number of tests that a site or a facility should be running for verification?
I wish that I could give people a, seven is the magic number, just do seven, but it's really going to depend on each individual facility's risk analysis. I do like to suggest to people that they take a good walk through their facility, identify, if you have not done so yet, a whole list of lots and lots and lots of potential test locations, fairly specific, so countertop would not be specific enough. Make a list of a couple dozen, a couple hundred if you're big enough. Use a randomizer and pick a certain amount to check each time you're doing that verification so that you're not checking the same spot every day and leaving some other spots without evaluation. And challenge yourself with your verification, whether you're doing 3 swabs or 30 swabs, don't always pick the really easy to clean stainless steel countertop. Make sure you're working in some nooks and crannies into that process.
Right. Great point. Thank you.
Absolutely. And this is my last slide, and then I'll throw it back to you. So when we're talking about proficiency testing, sometimes you're required to run it again for a third-party certification scheme. If you're running a test in-house, the scheme may want you to prove that the people who are doing the test are using the test correctly. But even if you are not required to run proficiency testing, you may find that it's a good thing for your location to do. It's sort of an additional validation level. So you validated that your equipment will work. You validated your cleaning plan will work. Proficiency testing validates that your people will work. It's kind of one way to think about it. So there's lots of proficiency testing studies out there. for a variety of allergen matrices. You can find a number of them without too much poking around. But if you are working and you want to do a PT study and you can't find an accredited study, you can certainly design one on your own. It would really just require making sure that the person doing the testing had a couple of samples in front of them and did not know which ones contained the allergen and in what sorts of quantities. Just keep in mind that if you're designing the study on your own, that may not be sufficient if you have this requirement to run the tests from a third party. So it can be great for internal use, may not check the boxes externally if this is something that you need to be doing on, let's say, an annual basis. And with that, I'm going to briefly put myself back on mute and relinquish control of the slide deck.
Thank you so much, Emily. That was a great presentation. Just really quick before we get into Q&A, again, I'll encourage everybody, if you've thought of a question or still wanted some clarification on something, please get that right into the question tab on the control panel on your screen. But I'm going to really quickly, while you're typing away with those urgent questions, I'm going to give you a little preview of our next three upcoming webinars. We've got about, I would say, probably one a week through the next couple of months, and we hope to see you join them. You can find them all listed on our website at pjrfsi.com. They are all free to register, and as with this webinar, they will all be recorded, and the slides will also be available online if you cannot attend for the live session. So, all right, I am going to get onto this screen. So this has Emily's contact information. If you wanted to learn more about Emport LLC, that website is right there. But let me go ahead and open up the questions tab and just see what we've got today. All right. Okay, let's see. We've got a long question slash statement here from Debbie Bruce. And I know, Debbie, you've been on many of our webinars, and I appreciate you joining us once again. For your information, Emily, Debbie is with the Canadian Anaphylaxis Initiative. So this is what she had to say. She says, store brands regularly state, quote unquote, may contain peanuts slash nuts due to the manufacturing policy of third-party suppliers. How can we work together, us being grocery stores, manufacturers, food safety companies, and end users, to eliminate the need for this where possible? I see food safety companies being a big part of this. It can lead to increased sales for businesses and increased access for the allergic, and it seems like a win-win. Any thoughts on that, Emily?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's such a hard it's a long question with no clear short answer. There are an increasing number of third-party programs that are designed specifically to look at. There are a number that have been around keeping gluten-free food safe for quite some time. There are some programs now that are working with other allergens, and so encouraging the brands that you encounter in the supermarket to think about that or to think about partnering with anaphylaxis organizations can certainly have a big role to play. I think that it's a real challenge because, of course, when those statements need to be deployed, they need to be there. But I know there have been some studies on how individuals at the consumer level respond to them, and it's a real challenge because they can lead to risk taking, but they can also lead to people staying away from products that are safe. There's unfortunately not a clear and easy answer, but it is an important topic.
Great, thank you. And thank you again, Debbie, for that input there. All right, we've got a question here, or a request from Ravi here, asking for you to go back and touch again on the gluten versus wheat debacle. It's a square, yeah. Rectangle, square. If you could get a little more into it. Specifically, Ravi said, do we have to declare gluten on the label when we're declaring wheat, or just declaring wheat covers gluten? Big question.
Got it. Yeah.
Square, rectangle, square.
Yeah, and it's a square, it's double because they're different on either side of the border, and then they're different ingredients. So within Canada, and I'll make a plug for the University of Nebraska's FARP program has a really lovely interactive tool on their page that lets people look at the globe and see at a glance which allergens are covered in which countries. So if anyone is, you know, manufacturing internationally, it's a great tool. I can share the link with people afterwards if they'd like. So within Canada, the priority allergens includes gluten. So if you're producing food in Canada, whether it's wheat or barley or rye, if it's in the product in any way, shape, or form, it needs to be called out very explicitly. If you're in the United States and there's wheat, whether it's the starch or the protein, if there's wheat, it needs to be called out very specifically. But if there's barley or rye, it doesn't necessarily need to be called out, which can make it a challenge if you need to be buying gluten-free foods in the States, because you can see something that's labeled as wheat-free, but that doesn't mean that it's gluten-free. It could have barley malt as a sweetener, and that would not be a gluten-free food, but it would be a wheat-free food. It could have rye as a, you know, an added whole grain, a number of others, but I think those are probably the two big ones. And in the opposite, you can find, and again, less so here than in other countries, but you can absolutely find products that are gluten-free, that are tested to be less than 20 parts per million, that are considered to be safe for people with celiac disease, that do contain wheat starch that has been specifically produced to be rendered as gluten-free, or occasionally also glucose syrup derived from wheat. And because those particular ingredients can be produced in a way that physically removes the protein, they can be a part of a gluten-free product, but the product would not be wheat-free. I hope that helped.
Yes, absolutely. If there's still a question about that, Ravi, please do ask any more additional clarifications in the question tab. We'd love to get you to the bottom of this issue. All right, we've got a question here from Ruth. Ruth is wondering, how often should, you know, testing and checks be run on your system? Once per lot, once per year? Any thoughts there?
Everyone's favorite answer, right? It depends. One of the really nice things about working with a third party program is that they'll often dictate to you exactly how often they want you to be testing. And that can kind of take the headache away. But it depends a lot on what your risk profile is. If you have a shared facility that you know is working with certain allergens and you're thinking about how to make sure that the lots that don't contain those allergens really don't contain those allergens, you're going to probably need to be doing more and more regular testing than if the only concern is that something could arrive into your facility that you didn't expect to be there, whether that's a contaminated ingredient that's coming to you with some unexpected additions, or that there's an issue, let's say, from the lunchroom where your staff takes their break and someone brings us, you know, has a bag of peanut butter M&Ms in their pocket or something like that. So depending on where your issues are, that'll dictate how often you need to be checking everything.
Absolutely. All right, we've got a question from Ali about peanut contamination. Ali is asking, is a customer request of 0 parts per million peanut protein in a product a rational request?
I mean, you can request anything, but in terms of what answers you can get when you're looking at allergen tests, you'll really never find anyone that's willing to give you an answer of is there zero or not. So the answer is more that they can say, I would like there to be no detectable peanut protein in this product, and that's reasonable. And the amount of peanut protein that various tests out there can detect is quite low, but you won't find a lab willing to sign off on zero as a number. You'll just find people willing to say the detection limit is, let's say, 1 parts per million, 2 parts per million, 5 parts per million, and we can promise you that if there is anything, it's below that threshold.
Excellent. Ali, I hope that answered your question. If you have any more, please do follow up. All right, we've got two separate questions, a two-part question here from Bonita. Bonita is wondering, first, testing negative would not allow you to not label an incoming product that states, quote-unquote, may contain. And that is the question. Do you need me to repeat that? It's worded a little bit confusingly.
Yeah, if you don't mind.
Would testing negative allow you to not label an incoming product that states, quote unquote, may contain XYZ?
So if you have an ingredient coming in and it says may contain peanuts and you run a test and you get a negative, do you need to carry that may contain statement on?
Yes, I believe I believe that is what the question intends. Benita, if that's incorrect, please do clarify.
And again, that's going to be a little bit of a that depends. That's something I think you'd want to look at on a case-by-case basis and talk a little bit more with your supplier to understand the size of the risk as it comes to you. And of course, also the size of the two-part question, right? How much ingredient is it that you're answering with one single test? And also how much is that ingredient as a component of your finished product?
Great. And Benita did pass along that was the correct interpretation of that question. So thank you. And then the second question from Benita is, where does validation come from on a yearly basis? So Benita, I'm not sure if you're looking for, are you referring to frequency of testing? If you wanted to expand on your question a little bit. Benita's clarifying, who dictates that it needs to be yearly?
So we see a lot of people who have SQF certification, for example, where there are yearly validation requirements. I would say in general, it's a good practice to be looking at validation on a yearly basis.
Great.
For cleaning programs.
Yeah, so it's a call back to that, it depends. our favorite answer there.
I know, unfortunately.
It's such a delicate field that you really have to lean on the it depends, because it's a case-by-case basis. All right, I think we have time for one or two more questions here. There is a question from, I apologize if I mispronounce this name, Rajesh. Are there any possible false positives that could arise from any testing kits? If so, which kits and for which allergens would this happen?
Sure. So short answer, yes. Longer answer, false negatives are, I would say, arguably more common than false positives and also more dangerous, because if you get a false positive, you'll run a second test, maybe you'll send it off to a lab and you can then, you know, adjust and ramp your anxiety back down accordingly, whereas a false negative could put a potentially dangerous product out in the marketplace. I can't answer to all test kits and all matrices. I can tell you, for example, the peanut kit that we work with, there are a couple of ingredients that in the moment we need to tweak the test a little bit if you're working with certain ingredients, just to make sure that they don't trigger a cross-reactive false positive if they're high enough percentage of the finished product. If there are things that trigger false positives, they should be spelled out pretty clearly in the manual of whatever kit it is that you're working with. You might see it as false positives. You might see it listed as cross-reactivity. You might just see, we don't suggest that you use this kit with these ingredients. But I know that reading the manuals can be a real challenge to stay interested in a very boring document the whole way through. But it's worth doing. And if there is going to be an issue, it should be spelled out pretty clearly in the kit manual.
All right. Fantastic. Rajesh, I hope that answers your question. All right. We've got, I think I'm going to throw this one last question in here. This one comes from Tina, and I'm going to throw this one in here because it's a more a personal question rather than a professional one. Tina says, I'm a grandmother to a child who was just verified as having a severe shellfish allergy. Are there any consumer level, so at home, I'm assuming, type tests to help verify that allergens are not present in items?
No. Short answer, no. There are, and that's for a few reasons. I know that there are a number of companies that are working on consumer level tests for allergens. So for example, we carry a gluten tox kit for home use, and in theory, a home user could use our Allertox sticks kits, but we don't recommend it. And that's for a number of reasons, but the biggest reason is that, well, two reasons. One, there are, you know, delicacies and intricacies to the kits that might be lost on a home user when it comes to the challenges of validating, for example. So if you're a facility and you know you're testing the same 10 things every time you're testing, you can do a validation and you can have that confidence that if there was an issue, you'd find it. But if you're at home, every time you run a test, it's going to be on a different product. And so you won't necessarily have the advantage of knowing if any particular product is going to be a challenge for the test kit. And the other issue is that the test kit can only tell you about what's in the little scoop of food that you're testing. Most kits require about a gram of food, so a really small amount. And if there's allergen in there, then the kit will find it. But if there was something elsewhere, I like to give the example of a salad. If you test part of a salad and there's no crouton in that spoonful, then you're going to think the salad is gluten-free. But it's not to say that elsewhere on the plate there isn't, you know, the crouton or the piece of lettuce that happened to be sitting on a piece of shrimp or whatever the case may be. And the test kit can't know about that because it hasn't looked at that portion of the dish. So unfortunately, at the consumer level, there's no great solutions right now.
All right. Thank you so much, Emily. I think that was the last question that we got in there. If anyone had any other questions, maybe a little shy, didn't want to ask your question live on the air, that's totally fine. I get it. Emily's contact info is right there up on the screen. If you have other questions about, allergen certification testing, audits, anything like that, we do absolutely encourage you to reach out to PGRFSI as well. Also, if you have any questions that maybe aren't specific to Emily's area of expertise, send us your questions and we will absolutely do our best to get them to someone who can answer them for you. You can just visit our website at pgrfsi.com and find all the various ways you can reach out to us. And I wanted to thank everyone for taking the time to attend today's webinar. I do apologize for the slightly delayed start, but I'm glad that you all stuck around. And Emily, thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule. I'm sure you're very busy.
Thank you for hosting us
about square rectangles and the differences on both sides of the border. Everyone, thank you again so much. And we hope to see you all in a future webinar. And Paul as well, yes. Have a great day, everyone, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks again.
Bye-bye.